You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Right. So thank you for coming back from break. You can never take those things for granted. I can tell you're an education crowd. Everybody's quiet. Never had this experience. So what I hope we can talk about today, and what motivates the work that we're going to talk about in the next hour or so, is very much the theme that we've been hearing all this morning with Jim and our panelists, which is how is it that growth and business dynamism can translate in people's ability to get ahead? Because this ethos that if you work hard, you get ahead is very ingrained in the American psyche. Probably comes from centuries of the immigrant experience. But the truth is that today, that's not the reality for many Americans. In today's economy, you can work hard and you can still make $9 an hour and have to hold three jobs and have a hard time making ends meet. So why is it that we have an increase in financial precariousness at a time where we've had 10 years of economic growth? And in part, I think this also fuels the growing divisiveness that we see in our political system, that many Americans are wondering why the system is not working for them. So this is what I want us to talk about today, we'll spend some time trying to understand what are the forces facing American workers, and more importantly, what can we do about it? How can we think about growth differently? So talking about the forces, by many accounts, we've been having a very long expansion. Actually, next month when the job numbers come up, this will have been the longest expansion in 7 decades, or since we started to track business cycles. Actually, unemployment is under 4%, which is and has been for a while, which is another historic low. But this is not translating, again, in people's ability to lead a better life. And there are a lot of reasons for this. One of them is this, is that there has been a decoupling of growth and productivity. So basically, as we've seen growth and productivity grow, it hasn't translated in more jobs or better jobs. And in part, this has a lot of explanations, but in part, it's this winner-take-all economic model that we see around software that is more and more dominating our economy. I mean, before, if you wanted to sell more widgets, you had to build more stores and hire more people. And now, if you want, many of the products and goods that we consume are digital, which means they can be distributed at zero marginal cost to millions of people. And this has in part led to returns accruing disproportionately to capital over labor. And as Needy described, so we've had this bifurcation, but a bunch of other things happening. Decreased wages, fewer people working for shorter spells, increase in those in the disability ranks, lower mobility, less new firm formation. And automation, which is something that Needy described, is revolutionizing our productive systems, right? From the assembly line to customer service, but it's also having this effect on jobs, this bifurcation of the labor market, where middle-skill jobs, and this is work by David Otter at MIT, from the last 40 years has been going down. And it's become harder for people from these jobs to transition to the high-skill jobs. And the jobs at the bottom are becoming crappier, and that's a technical term. lower wages, more unreliable hours, less benefits. And this is affecting people's ability to stay in the workforce. And one of the, I think, scariest stats that we've seen is that people are dropping out of the workforce. And this is a trend, again, that has been going on for the last 40 years. Right now, if you think of all men, 11% of men are not in the workforce. And that is coming down from a low of 3% in the 1960s. And if you think about workers with less than a BA, that number becomes one out of four men are not in the workforce. And this is a population of 28 million people. And also salaries have stagnated. They've recently recovered, but for the last 40 years, salaries have gone down. For men at 28%, for men without a college degree or who have not finish high school, 66%. And there's a lot of reasons and some things that we don't understand of why wage has stagnated. But in part, we know that there's been an increase in monopoly power. We have seen in the last 10 years more concentration in 70% of industries in the U.S., the demise of unions, practices like non-competes and non-poaching agreements that have proliferated in the low end for hourly workers. And just in general, workers at the bottom having less agency, less ability to move between jobs or negotiate higher salaries. And this is having this effect, which we have talked about and is widely studied here in Brookings, which is that the middle class, which is the engine behind sustained economic growth, is shrinking. In 229 of the largest metros, from the 229 of the largest metros, the middle class is shrinking in 203 of those metros. And companies, driven by margin pressures and competition and more efficient platforms, are also able to compartmentalize work and more easily contract it away. And contract work means, all kinds of flexibility and savings for people, but also for a large proportion of the population, which McKinsey calls the reluctance, it also has meant, who need to do this out of necessity, has also meant, less benefits. These are workers that now have to think about their own upward trajectory. They need to understand what the skills of the future are going to bring. And by many accounts, this today makes 35% of the American workforce. 35% of the American workforce engages in contract work. And this is something that we have yet to see the economic consequences of this, as these people who, again, do not have the kind of traditional benefits that took, the last 100 years to associate with work and their lack of savings. And at a time where there is a premium of skills, and this is research from Mark Moreau at the Metro Program that shows that digital skills are becoming more important at every level of job category. So at a time that this is happening, corporate training is going down. And lastly, mobility. So at a time where we have wage stagnation and a bifurcation of the labor market, the institutions that were beacons of mobility, college, education, healthcare, childcare, housing, all of these things are becoming not only more expensive, but also less able to deliver on that mobility. This is a graph, again, by the research of Raj Chetty that shows that your access to college and also your access to good quality college is almost 100% determined by your parental income. So I think my goal was not necessarily to depress you, but I think I have accomplished that, and it's not even, lunchtime. But what we want to talk about is how do we think about the solution space? This is how we are trying to organize the three buckets where we think we should be thinking about in terms of what we can do in confronting the challenges of future of work. One is growth, and that's the demand side. We need to grow and create better jobs. I think growth is the key for creating opportunity, although how you grow matters, and we'll be talking about that. The second piece is people. Helping people transition to those jobs, particularly low-wage workers who are being the ones left behind. And this is work that you're going to hear later this afternoon. And third, we need to not only reinforce, but at times kind of reimagine the institutions that are responsible for bringing mobility. These are housing, schooling, transport, etc. So that people's hard work can actually translate into a better life. Now, these three are inexorably linked in that if we just focus on the supply side, you know, we'll have PhDs driving Uber taxis. But if we also only focus on the growth part, eventually what we'll see is what we're seeing now, people not being able to transition to those opportunities and dropping out of the workforce, and eventually the most competitive firms not settling here. So I think the timing right now is actually quite propitious for us working in bolder ways around these three areas. We have a tight labor market, which means, and we've already started to see some recuperation from people coming back into the labor force, wages moving up. So there's a pressure for companies to think differently around how are they going to get the talent that they need, but also to deal with the social consequences of the unequal growth that we have been seeing. So I now want to take you to a slightly different world. I want you to kind of go up with me outside of the U.S. to the world, because we're going to talk about this first quadrant, and it's kind of where the research that we're presenting today is focused on. But I want us to go back to the world, and then we're going to come back to the U.S. So I spent almost a decade at the Center for International Development at Harvard, and there we were trying to understand how countries grew. How did you get countries out of poverty traps? And this question about how growth happens, it's at the crux of what we're hoping to share with you today. And what we realize when we think about just growth is that growth actually didn't characterize humanity for the longest time. And this is work by Madison. If you stretch that to year zero to 1800, no country grew. It's a straight line. And then in the last 200 years, we had a massive acceleration. And when that acceleration happened, countries like the U.S. and Japan accelerated tremendously in growth. The U.S. grew 25 times in the last 200 years. And some countries got left behind. And our traditional models that try to explain why did this happen are actually ill-equipped in explaining the variations of growth. We've had, you know, the neoclassical kind of growth model that says, well, if you just accumulate these things, more land, more labor, more capital, more human capital, more schooling, you're going to grow. Well, we know that this has not explained variation in growth. You know, we've also had lots of great advice, usually coming from this town, you know, the Washington Consensus, which are all great advice for countries of stabilize, privatize, liberalize, and you're going to grow. Well, many countries did that, all good advice. Many did not grow. So the work that Ricardo Hausman and others did at the Growth Lab at Harvard was trying to explain growth from a different perspective. And they used, you know, big data and analytics to post that the reason countries grew is because they learned how to make new and better things. And that so not just more of the same, new and better products and services. And they actually were able to measure the diversity and the complexity of a country's industrial base and gave that number or that metric a name of economic complexity. And they saw that economic complexity, what you're able to make, not only is correlated with growth, but is predictive of future growth. And this measure of economic complexity by country actually was 10 times better in predicting economic growth than the World Economic Forum indicators and the doing business indicators, that governance indicators, schooling indicators, and not because these are not important things for countries to have, but because they are embedded in what you're able to produce and make. So the question is, why haven't countries grown? Now I've told you the secret of growth, that you need to make more and more diverse products. And the way that you make more and more diverse products is by building capabilities, right? These are capabilities come in many forms. There are the talent and specialized knowledge that you need to make new products. There are efficient roads and, you know, rule of law and logistics and good customs and, you know, all these capabilities that are necessary. And if I tell you, okay, you just accumulate capabilities and you make a diverse set of products, you should be able to grow. But there are many places that have been left behind, right? Why is it, if I just told you the secret of growth, that we still have poverty in American cities around the world? And it's because this process of growth and building capabilities for growth has a chicken and egg problem. And that's the chicken in the picture here. Let me give you an example. I'm originally from Bolivia, right? Why would I become a biotech engineer in Bolivia if there is no biotech industry? And how would a biotech industry ever evolve in Bolivia if I didn't become a biotech engineer and 100 of my best friends? And even if we did, there'd be 100 other capabilities that we need in that place for that industry to thrive. So growth has this chicken and egg problem, right? Which has countries stuck and places stuck. And the question is now, how do you get out of this chicken and egg dilemma? Because the world has evolved. The world has diversified. And the way that it has diversified is by moving to nearby products. And you're like, well, what does the hell does nearby mean? And nearby means products that share capabilities, right? So if you have a certain set of capabilities place and you're able to make shirts for men, what is it that you need to add to make shirts for women, right? You kind of use a lot of the same capabilities and you add a little bit. And the world has evolved this way. And what the team at Harvard was able to do was to try to measure exactly this distance. And this is how they did it. And this is not a Pollock painting. This is actually just a lot of data. And what it is 1,000 products. Each circle is a product. And on 128 countries and 65 years of trade data. And what this has done, just using new tools, it's same old data, but using new tools to organize it, is that the way that this network is built is done so that if products are likely to be produced by the same country, these products are close together. So this green cluster over here is garments. So if, you know, one of those circles is shirts for men, the other one's shirts for women. And in the way that the world has evolved, these tend to be produced by the same place, that cluster is together. If countries that make shirts for men are not likely to make microwaves, that's far apart. And every dot here, so the light blue are the microwaves and the ovens and the microchips. The dark colors in the middle are machinery. The purple is chemicals. And this actually explains why places get left behind, in that not all industries share capabilities with other industries that would make the process of growth faster. So many of the poor countries and poor places are stuck in industries, sometimes in the peripheries, whose capabilities to make that product are not easily redeployed to others. So up there, that big circle on top is oil. It's a very sophisticated industry. It actually requires very sophisticated capabilities, but it's not shared by other industries that could use that to diversify, and countries get stuck there. So using this map, we were able to answer a few questions, which not only how fast you're going to grow, but also based on what you make today, I can tell you what you're likely to make tomorrow. And some industries, again, are more interesting than others. So, well, with this data, we were able to show which countries are likely to grow and with what speed. In our project here at Brookings, we were able to replicate the analysis to do the same for the U.S. So we have measured the complexity of 917 metropolitan and micropolitan areas in the U.S. and mapped 285 industries. And similarly, with this, we can predict growth, which I think is interesting, but not really the question that we're here to answer, right? What we did is, again, created two networks because we had the availability of data. One that does the same as the product space created at Harvard, that maps industries by the probability of co-location. But we also created another network, which maps industries by the the occupations that they share. Because we think that, you know, just like certain products are going to require similar capabilities, like, you know, selling asparagus or, you know, flowers will require, you know, a cold storage transport chain. If Amazon is, you know, successful in Seattle and has to hire, you know, 60% computer scientists, then other industries that use that kind of labor are likely to co-locate. And this is what we see. And we've used these two networks to be able to predict more effectively the kind of rise and decline of industries, which, again, we can tell you what is likely to appear, what industries are more attractive in terms of the capabilities that are shared by other complex industries, and which ones share complementary inputs. So this is the kind of insights that we're hoping to provide cities as they navigate this question of growth. So these are two metrics that we're able to show from that analysis that I just showed you. So what is this? So these are two cities. South Bend, so every node is a industry. And these are industries that are present in that city but are not there with strength. This is, the green is South Bend and the blue is Nashville. And based on the network analysis, we can tell you which industries are more feasible or less feasible based on your current structure. And then which industries are more strategic, which means not only which ones are more complex, but which ones, if you were able to have that industry develop in your city, that it would be able to build the capabilities that would be used by other complex industries. So in an ideal world, because you can't have any, you know, output without a 2x2 matrix, you would be in the upper right. There's nothing in the upper right. And this shows why it is hard to grow. But what we see with South Bend, a small city that has struggled after the demise of its manufacturing industry, is that most of the complex and strategic things for the South Bend are not close, are not feasible. So it is going to have to chart a path of consolidating what it has and moving up this complexity and strategic track. Nashville, on the other hand, a city has been thriving and is probably one with highest propensity of growth, has a bunch of industries that are feasible, but when it has to decide in using its scarce tax dollars where to invest it, in terms of what capabilities to build for what industries, it should choose the ones that are more strategic versus those lower down. And what we hope is to provide this map that allows cities to think about their growth differently and be purposeful as to what industries they attract. So let me tell you, let's use an example of putting these kind of insights to work and how a city might use this. So let's talk about Boise, Idaho, which is a city that in Idaho, which is the fastest growing state in the nation. Boise last year was one of the top five fastest growing cities in our country. And Boise has a fascinating story, and we're going to hear about it in the panel. But in a way, a very sophisticated tech cluster started there, which was an unlikely place 50 years ago, and actually started with HP, which set up shop there and created a bunch of capabilities that then other very sophisticated industries that were growing at the time were able to use, from attracting quality talent to building the infrastructure. And as other industries, for example, like Simplon, which was making, you know, the potato chips that McDonald's uses, was starting to enter into advanced manufacturing using technology, most of these firms worked together to build a set of very sophisticated capabilities that brought about the core, the engine of this quite sophisticated growth. But what has happened in the last 10 years, which is what we show you here, is that growth has not been maintained, and the quality of that growth, in that despite Boise having grown at 10% in job growth in the last 10 years, all of that growth has been on the low end, or most of that growth. So all the industries on the left here are hospitality, entertainment, ag, are all below the median wage in Boise. And when you look at the salaries, which are these two bubbles, which show the difference between salaries in 2007 and 2017, salaries have stayed low. So when you're thinking about Boise and trying to understand, okay, how could I think, how can I turn this around to make sure that the growth that comes next is not bringing me more poverty and more inequality, which is the current situation, as we've seen median wages decrease 6% and, you know, almost half of the workforce, low-wage workforce in Boise. So these are the kind of tools that we hope cities to make available, and we hope that cities are able to use. And this is an example of the kind of things that we want to be able to say, okay, what is likely to appear and is close to you, what is likely to disappear, and also provide insights for companies that are trying to enter different cities. So this is an example of Boise, where we want to understand, you know, this feasibility, which are the industries that are likely to appear. We want to, again, we're able to look at all industries from how complex they are or how strategic they are. We usually, when we're thinking about industries we want to attract, we want to look at tradable industries, because it is tradable industries that actually create the jobs. For every job in the tradable industry, 2.5 other jobs get created in terms of, you know, restaurants and coffee shops and whatnot. So here we can see, for example, all right, if we have similar feasibility, this industry of beverage manufacturing, which actually uses a lot of complex capabilities, is more attractive, interesting, and strategic than general purpose machinery. And then maybe if we look at other industries, like, oh, this looks very big and has a lot of jobs, travel accommodation, right? But does it have the jobs that we want? What happens if we think about providing good jobs for people with BAs? That circle shrinks, right? So it becomes a less interesting industry. And same if we look at what is going to provide good jobs for people who don't have a BA, which is, you know, the majority of people in Boise. But then basic chemical manufacturing become more interesting. So this is the kind of data that we're hoping to show. But it also, aside from playing offense, it can also be helpful in playing defense, right? In that here we have the probability of disappearance of industries. And what we can see is a little bit of what we've talked about before, that the technology industries that brought the growth in Boise are the ones that are most a threat and in disappearing. And this is something that we saw on the ground. HP is a shadow of its old self. It employs 1/4 of the employees it once did. Micron, which is another great microprocessor company that started in Boise, is now expanding everywhere but Boise. And many of the industries, companies in the technology industry are having trouble finding the talent to continue to grow. But so it gives you a sense of what are the kind of industries that you should protect and create more density, and bring more industries to create to make sure that the right capabilities evolve. And this is one last example on this idea of disappearance, which is South Bend. South Bend, as you know, went for a massive decline through the last decades, but in the last 10 years has started to build resilience in the manufacturing industry. So if we look at manufacturing and we look at the vulnerability of this industry through time from 2002 to 2017, you see that they all moved to the left, which means that they have become less likely to disappear. And then I think I do it again because it's nice to see bubbles move. And this is the last thing that I hope to show you, which is we're hoping that this is something that that companies are able to use when they think about where to locate. Because just like we can tell cities, we can also think, when we think of an industry, say, what are the places that have the capabilities to be able to make you successful? And so that these choices and these conversations with governments and cities are one that happen through capabilities and not necessarily tax incentives. So what this shows us is that if you're in dairy product manufacturing, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Spokane are very interesting places. And also what we saw is, for example, we know that Chobani, big yogurt manufacturer, set up shop in 2012 in Twin Falls, right next to Boise. And it has made a $750 million investment in that plant. So it's not surprising that Boise appears there as having the capabilities to be able to host this industry, because it's nearby. So to conclude, I think if there are two things that I'd love for you to take away from this work, and it's kind of where we want to go with this work, is that one size does not fit all. So each city, each community needs to start to chart, as it thinks of charting its own path to towards growth, it needs to understand its own strengths, its possibilities, its the needs of its people, and our work is trying to influence that. And if there are any insights that we think are city-specific, that the answer would be different. The data and the analysis exists to be able to inform those choices. And secondly, I think this is a message for companies, too, that as that they're deciding where to locate and where they can grow, that they do so and think about it in this language of capabilities, that they work with city officials, but with other companies on how to build those set of capabilities that, again, unlike tax incentives, might not make them more profitable, but in the end, will make them more productive and also will make sure that the cities that they live in become more prosperous for all. So with that, I actually want to bring up to the stage companies that I hope we can have a conversation about this because they're doing exactly that. And I want to invite Camille Bousset, who will be our moderator. She's a senior fellow and director of the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative. So thank you. I get to keep my Madonna microphone.
So while everybody is getting mic'd up, I want us to give Marcella a really warm hand of applause for her excellent presentation.
Thank you.
So this particular session is building off of her presentation, and the question we're asking here is how do you build a workforce so that you can actually accomplish the kind of growth that you have outlined in your presentation? So what we're going to do here, the format for this particular panel is I'm going to introduce our excellent panelists. I'm going to ask them to provide a rather brief description of the kind of work that they have done to incentivize workforce development in their particular locations. And then I have a couple of questions for them and for Marcella. And then we're going to open it up for question and answers from the from all of you. So let me start off by introducing my panelists. So sitting next to me is Bill Abey. He's the general manager and global head for, what's PS Services?
Personal System Services.
PC Business for HP Incorporated, based in Boise. Thomas Sylvester, who is the Vice President of Site Operations for Amgen, Rhode Island. And sitting next to him is Scott Jensen, Director of the Department of Labor and Training for Rhode Island. And then, of course, Marcella. So I want to start off by first welcoming you all, and I encourage you all to take a look at their very impressive bios, which are part of the general packet for this event. I'm going to start off with you, Bill. Marcella talked a lot about Boise and some of the pattern of growth there, which was high growth at first, and then we seem to have plateaued, and there appear to be some clouds on the horizon. HP's been there a really long time. Tell me a little bit about how HP has, first of all, decided to try to grow talent in that area. What are sort of some of the precepts around that? And then what have been some of the results? And what you're thinking about as you're moving into a more challenging future?
Yeah, absolutely. So HP entered Boise in 1972. Mm-hmm. Was the first technology firm to come to Boise, Idaho. Mm-hmm. Boise actually was a very successful corporate headquarters city before that. Albertson started there. Morrison Knudsen, who you may not have heard of, but they did little projects like Hoover Dam and Wake Island was out of Boise, Idaho. You had J.R. Simplot, who invented the flash frozen French fry during World War II to feed the troops. And more critically, he then sold it to the Crocs for McDonald's. Mm-hmm. and made more money than the Crocs did by selling them French fries. I actually ended up making about $1 million investment in a little company that became Micron Computers. Mm-hmm. Coming out of that. But HP was the first technology company there. And it began to create this nexus of other companies that built off that. And Micron would be an example. And you know, Marcella was showing the dots earlier, and I'd send her a graph where we have something very similar for Boise, where you can see this kind of nexus of HP, Boise State, later Micron Computers, created this real growth pattern. And throughout the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s, we grew rather rapidly. Now, a lot of that technology back then wasn't necessarily technology of how we think about it now. It was certainly R&D and knowledge workers, but it was also a lot of manufacturing. And over the years, those manufacturing roles moved elsewhere. But the knowledge workers and the R&D intensified. But along with that, our education system didn't keep up. And so we're not able to educate the number of people we need in Idaho in order to fully staff not just our company, but all the other companies that have emerged in Idaho since that time. And so we've had to attract labor from outside. So we now, and I think we'll talk about this a little more, but we now put a lot of effort in working with other community leaders, other businesses, and the state and the legislature on improving outcomes for education in the state of Idaho.
Great, excellent. Thank you very much. Thomas, much the same question for you. Yeah, welcome.
Thanks again for the invitation. I really appreciate being in front of you today. And most of you know an HP product. You have seen it. You know the logo. Some of you might not know an Amgen product. If you have an Amgen product in your hand, you are severely sick. Amgen is a pioneer in the biotech industry. We were founded in 98, and we have a very clear mission to serve patients. We operate in 6 therapeutic areas. And I think to your question, there are 2 reasons why you would join Amgen first and then why you stay with Amgen, right? And maybe I want to reflect on that a little bit. Most people are attracted to Amgen because of our mission. We work in an industry where at the end of the day you come back and you made a difference in people's lives. And often it's people who are very close to us and you have helped them to go through a cancer therapy, overcome cholesterol and all of this, right? I was attracted because of the mission, but also because it's one of the companies that does the coolest science in the world. We generate on one day as much scientific data as a small company in a year. The company is founded on a very strong belief of values, and these are behavioral values. And now I come to the second part of why people stay with Amgen for more than a decade or longer. And this is because of the people that you interact with every day. These behavioral values, they have ingrained. One of them, for instance, is teamwork, trust and respect others, compete intensely and win. This has created a family that you will not find anywhere else so quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why people stay with Amgen. But what are we doing to your key question of really helping them to develop over a decade, or many of us are 20 years and more in the company. I'm 18 years with the company. We have 2 separate sets of goals. One is a goal that is an annual goal that measures what you deliver and how you deliver against these values, these behavioral values. And then there's another set of goal that is called the career development plan. This is where we take a very personal view into your career and ask you to plan for the next 3, 5, or 10 years, your career life on multiple pathways. We provide mentors from the company, external mentors as well. So we really make your kind of life and work at Amgen kind of really exciting for you for your entire career, right? And I'm really excited. I'm a product of that. I've moved around with the company, and we had a little bit of mobility. I distinguish between geographic mobility. Some of us are sometimes in our lives geographically mobile to a lot of places or a few places. What you should always stay is functionally mobile. Stay a continuous learner. That allows you to really shape your own career to your fullest satisfaction. That's why some people stay with Amgen.
That's excellent. Thank you. Scott, so you're based in Rhode Island, and Rhode Island, when people think of Rhode Island, they don't think of it as the hub, for instance, of the biotech industry, but you obviously have been able to attract some real giants. Can you talk a little bit about how the state of Rhode Island is thinking about workforce planning, how they attract companies, particularly in this Northeast corridor, which has already some strength in biotech and biopharmaceuticals?
Sure. Well, again, like everybody else, it's great to be here. But I'd point out that while the size of a county in most states, Rhode Island was the place where the Industrial Revolution was born in the United States. A lot of fabrics were manufactured in Rhode Island. When Governor Raimondo was elected 4.5 years ago now, she made her first, second, and third priorities economic development and workforce development. Because Rhode Island's economy had gone to become the costume jewelry manufacturer for the world, and that's all gone. And it left in about, through the last 20 years, it just drip, drip, drip. And we needed to change, and we needed to do exactly what you all are describing, which is find our strengths and really build on them. So I run the Labor Department, and what that means for Rhode Island, in the governor's eyes for sure, is a program we started called Real Jobs Rhode Island, which is it's a grant program. It is a sector-based workforce development program, and in that way, it's sort of a typical best practice, but the difference is we are trying to take that approach to scale in Rhode Island. And what that means is we're in the business of trying to create workforce solutions for our companies. That if you need something, we will try to find it. That is our job to make that happen. That means kind of perspicuous investment. So it's not good enough to drop a new curriculum at the community college. It's that plus let's make a recruiting capacity that can reach into communities much better and find people who might be very talented but would maybe get missed. Mm-hmm. And then sort of the third thing is to make sure that the government bureaucracy remains my problem. Mm-hmm. And my staff's problem and not Thomas's problem. So between those three things, the idea is to really put talented Rhode Islanders in the game in a much more efficient and effective way than anybody else. Excellent. So that's the governor's vision.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Marcella, so, we have two companies here, and obviously the state of Rhode Island, which has really been in the forefront of trying to figure out how to continue to develop a workforce for the 21st century and how to attract folks to their either companies or location. What have you seen in your research? What have you seen work well, particularly for workforce development? And here I'm thinking about the potential partnerships between governments and companies. Have you seen anything there that you think would be helpful to informing this conversation?
No, it's a good question. And I think we have great examples here, and I think later today we're also going to talk to Stephen, who was in part responsible for bringing Amazon to Virginia, who has a great example on how it was a workforce play and focus. I think the concept that I'd like to introduce as we think about these solutions is kind of the specificity of knowledge. Like, as we're thinking about, how do places are able to make more complex things, right? You're going to need the base of education that we're going to talk about in the afternoon. But the specificity of knowledge that you need to do the products that we were talking about, any of these, really is best acquired inside of the companies, right? The whole post-secondary infrastructure needs to help and create those general and specific skills. But the more companies are able to participate in the process of providing those specific skills, the better people and the productivity of companies is going to be. And I think that the more that conversation between cities and companies becomes specific, not just in talent, but in a whole set of capabilities, the better the outcome. And right now, what I see is sometimes that, as many businesses gather together in different industry associations and chambers of commerce, but when the Chamber of Commerce has to advocate for industry, what's the only one thing that will be the same for a warehouse as to an Amgen? It's like tax incentives, right? Or tax reductions. So the more we have less intermediaries for places in companies to understand about those specific needs, the more productive those conversations become.
Great, excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much. So I have a couple questions for each of you. And I want to start off with you, Scott, actually. So there are many elements to attracting talent. And, you know, one could safely say that without some very significant government strategy and planning, Rhode Island might have been left behind, mm-hmm. right? So tell me a little bit about some of the challenges that Rhode Island has faced. You alluded to those a little bit. And what, how it is you see a combination of different strands of policy working together. So, for instance, when you're thinking about workforce, you're thinking about housing. You're also thinking about education. You're obviously thinking about how it is you attract companies to your area or keep them there, right? So, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I think the way we approach it in Rhode Island is we really try to run things through, we try to focus what we're doing through the lens of demand. And that's different than having a demand-informed conversation or something like that. If I can talk with a company and I can find out that they need a finite number of definite individuals, I can reverse engineer. And, you know, where am I going to get those people? And do those people need childcare? And what is their housing situation? So I think if you look at a typical workforce investment in the United States, maybe $5,500 a person, and that seems reasonable. Mm-hmm. But it isn't reasonable if it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So if you invest $10,000 in a person, mm-hmm. and that person is successful in getting a great position in Amgen, for instance, your return on investment is much greater. And, you know, you can stand up in public and say, yes, I invested twice as much money and it worked. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's the biggest challenge. We need to think a little bit differently about the kind of investments we need to make and the kind of story we need to tell people, the taxpayers who are making these investments. And, you know, I think if you can really focus on the result and think of it like a workforce solution. That's the main obstacle to overcome.
So let me ask you a follow-up question on that. You know, it's I think you have a success story, obviously, and you can point to successes. But if you're thinking about other localities where they haven't enjoyed that success and now they're thinking about, you know, potentially making a more significant investment, what are some of the guidelines you would
sure.
and suggestions you would provide to them?
Again, I mean, I think the first thing that you really need to do is sit down and have a very detailed conversation with the companies that make up the strength of the economy you're trying to work in. Mm-hmm. First, of course, for all of the reasons I've just said, but right. also they're great advocates. Mm-hmm. They are connected to local chambers of commerce. Many of our real jobs partnerships are run by trade associations. So you are building a constituency at the same time. And when you're able to marry a business constituency because you're actually going to be able to provide value mm-hmm. We all want to do good. We want to see our neighbors thrive. And when you're able to marry those two constituencies, you usually can really make an impact to get some different things done that normally would be impossible.
Great. Thank you very much. So, Thomas, I'm going to move to you, and let's talk a little bit about Amgen. You mentioned to me in the other room that you're expanding. Amgen is expanding in Rhode Island, so that's always a good sign, right? So tell me a little bit about how, why it is you're expanding in the following sense. So what is it about the workforce that signals that expansion is a good idea for you in Rhode Island? And then secondly, what has been the role of Amgen's relationship with government in the thought process at Amgen headquarters about expanding in Rhode Island?
So maybe I go back a little bit in time. Amgen moved into Rhode Island in 2001 when we acquired an existing site from a competitor for a product called Enbrel. And at that point, we built the site out with a new facility, very large, became one of the largest drug substance manufacturing plants in the United States for a while. We had a large hiring wave, hired about 1,800 people to the site. And because I explained to you earlier, people love to stay with a company. We really didn't have a talent problem for a good decade. And about 2 years ago, the company saw an increased demand and decided we need to build additional plant capacity. We looked at the entire world. We ultimately ended up in Rhode Island out of a multitude of reasons, one being the location needed to fit into our global footprint strategy here, because the material that I make is only three stages away from a final product, so it needs to be shipped across the world, so certain locations are more advantaged than others. One big reason was access to talent. And the Rhode Island location in the Boston-New York corridor gives you access to talent, particular manufacturing talent. And Scott was alluding to the history of Rhode Island is deeply, deeply ingrained in manufacturing jobs. And one of the third reasons was we needed to make sure that when we built the plant, it gets also licensed with a high probability of success. And that is sometimes difficult if you choose a completely new location where you are not present in. And the Rhode Island plant enjoys an extremely high reputation with all regulatory agencies in the world. So that was the three reasons kind of that we ended up in kind of Rhode Island here. The challenges we face really as it relates to talent a story of kind of two chapters. The first chapter is based on the new plant. We are hiring about 150 or more middle-class job, high middle-class jobs here. So there's a short-term need. But then we are also facing over the next years a retirement and generation change. So I know Scott loves to run, right? You love to run. So I use a track and field kind of analogy here. Our strategy is a little bit like we are moving from a middle distance race, hiring these 150 people or more immediately into a marathon. And that's kind of how we look at the strategy and what we have to develop. And this is really where Scott and the team really came together. Often Rhode Island is has a lot of disadvantages of being small. I think being the smallest state I've seen helps to really foster very strong teamwork among every stakeholder in the state here. We see each other on many, many occasions, different venues, different teams here. And I think in just the 3 years I'm on the side, I've seen a strategy taking shape here between all stakeholders, government, schools, university, colleges, companies that we are interested in sustainable growth of talent, creating jobs, and ultimately growing the economy in the state, right? And it all, we're all speaking the same language as we come together, and I think it really takes off. It has created momentum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I'm going to give you a slightly different question. So I know based on the conversations we've had, you know, prior to the actual session, that you can share with us an interesting example of how important it is to understand and shape the social environment within which your organization is situated. And this is especially important if you want to attract diverse and global talent. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about some of the social factors in the community in Boise that can make it easier or more difficult to attract a diverse and global workforce, and how has HP addressed those factors?
Yeah. So let me come at this from two ways. One will be from kind of a diversity and inclusion, which is a big part of our strategy.
Okay.
And then second, via education. And actually, let me start with the second one, education. So we at HP have a strong sense of social responsibility. And that crosses many different vectors from D&I through education.
Diversity and inclusion, D&I.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Into things like sustainability. Mm-hmm. Specifically to our recruitment and how we attract talent, if we start with the education piece, you know, we do it at the global level. Gus Schmidtlin, who's here, leads our education practice and pioneered the National Education Technology Assessment, which we've done with countries like Peru, Ecuador, Hungary, Indonesia, to help them assess where they're at from an education perspective, where they need to go. We've now actually now taken that down locally, and we're doing a study in the state of Idaho. How that came about is Gus and I were having a conversation around this NEDA assessment. And really, it was focused at the time on developing economies. But if you look at, and I hate to say this because I'm from Idaho, but if you look at our statistics and our educational outcomes, we look a lot like a developing economy, right? In fact, Jim kind of framed it up in his early data when he talked about that happy path to success. I'll stay away from the planned, unplanned pregnancy. That's not my area of expertise. But I will tell you that the next step was showing up ready to be educated in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. 49% of the kids in Idaho show up not ready to be educated. Mm-hmm. Definition of ready to be educated is ABC, 1, 2, 3, print your name and know a few colors. Right, 49% of our kids can't do that. We talk about learning to read by the third grade so that after that you can read to learn. Half our kids don't achieve that statistic. And so we believe from a community perspective, it's incumbent on HP, it's incumbent on other companies, it's incumbent on the community partnerships we have to kind of raise all boats with that rising tide. Mm-hmm. And so to that end, we've done a number of things over the years, but are currently in the process participating with Marcella and with Gus, as well as with Idaho Business for Education, to create a study where we're assessing kind of the baseline of where Idaho is in right now on education methods and outcomes and how that can be improved. And we'll deliver that to the governor in about a month. The real importance of that is you have to understand kind of the state of politics in Idaho. I think it's well known we're a red state. You could perhaps even argue we're the reddest state. Two cycles ago, the Democrats ran an independent and the Republicans ran a libertarian, just to give you an idea of how far it is. And what that means is we have a legislature that has very strong opinions on taxation, keeping it down, very strong opinions on spending, keeping that down, and even stronger opinions on education and things that should be done in the home. And so for that reason, we're one of a very few states that spend $0 getting kids actually ready for school. And so we at HP believe that we're in a position to go drive that conversation and improve those outcomes, and with other business leaders, approach the legislature with something they're not used to hearing, which is tax us more, spend more, improve these outcomes, create these better outcomes that Jim talked about, both for society as a whole, as well as, frankly, as employers, right? We need that talent. And so that's a place that we put a lot of our energy in, again, at the global level, the national level, and then I've had the great opportunity to become involved at the state level. The other thing we focus on heavily in a differentiated way is diversity and inclusion. We talk about talent as our only criteria, but we really put wood behind the arrow on that. And again, Jim did the perfect setup this morning, but if you're out there trying to attract talent in a very competitive market, we have these big groups of marginalized people that are incredibly talented. But all you have to do is look at the statistics, whether it's folks from an LGBTQ community or folks from a people of color community. One that we're actually spending a lot of effort on now that we had in the past, which is new, is folks that are on the spectrum, right? We have these people that are just incredibly talented on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, and they can do great things, especially in an industry like ours, right? Think about a software engineer, mm-hmm. how powerful they could be, but they don't have the traditional interview skill set, right? They walk into a job interview, they walk out, they got no job. And so we're actually reframing how we go out and do job interviews for people that we know that are on the spectrum to be able to identify the skills and talents that they can bring to bear. And if you think about it from just a pure social responsibility perspective, we think that's a great thing, right? Even if we weren't driving some HP benefit out of that, we think that's a great thing. But then from an HP perspective, absolutely gives us a competitive advantage. And so when we talk about driving diversity, we do that. The other thing is inclusion. And too often the word goes diversity and inclusion, and the immediate discussion goes to diversity, which is largely a hiring, retention, advancement decision. Right, which means it's kind of solely held with management in the company, right? Because non-managers don't get the opportunity to hire, they don't get the opportunity to promote, they don't typically drive advancement. But inclusion is something that everybody does every day. And we like to say we want folks to be able to show up at HP as their whole self, whoever that is. They don't need to act like me or talk like you or be like them. You know, it's show up, and so that might be a millennial that has a lot more accoutrements as they come to work, or somebody more like myself that doesn't have as many accoutrements or any hair. But we really think from an inclusion perspective, diversity are kind of these big decisions you make, and they're largely held with management. But inclusion is every single person, every single day, every single hour. Every person in the company at every moment of the day has an opportunity to do something that will make people feel like they're part of the club or to make them feel like they're not a part of the club. And to the extent that we can drive inclusion, we think it also helps drive that diversity angle. So the two pieces we're really focused on is raising the tide with education at the global level, at the national level, and certainly within Idaho, and then driving specifically on diversity and inclusion, both from a social responsibility perspective, as well as, frankly, a sustainable competitive advantage.
Thank you very much. I wanted to go back to you with a similar question. Mm-hmm. You know, Amgen obviously operating in a very competitive environment in biotech, and with a tremendous pipeline workforce in the sort of Boston Northeast corridor, but still people can go to a lot of different companies. You have a lot of talented people, and there are a lot of different opportunities for them. In terms of ensuring that you have a diverse workforce, what are some of the steps that Amgen has taken there?
So, yeah, I think you, the HP story is really interesting and mirrors a little bit also what we do at Amgen here on the diversity and inclusion. Maybe I start, like, we operate not only in the Boston area as well. You refer to this, we are present in 100 countries, and we engage with all communities in these 100 countries wherever we are here. The New England, the Boston area is a quite competitive area. It's the biotech hub in our industry. This is where everything is happening in the world of biotech here. It's very competitive. We have successes. We have also losses. Diversity is very important for the company. It starts, like you're referring to, at the hiring stage already. And then really the inclusion part, similar to the way you described it very elegantly, really everybody's opinion wants to be heard, needs to be heard. We have certain chapters for certain groups in the company. They are present in certain locations more than in others. Rhode Island happened to be, I have to admit, not a highly diversified location yet. We are 670 people there compared to over 4,000 in other locations here. So you get a certain kind of tilted and artificial kind of diversity, right? And we are working on that. We are actively fostering this. So to the teaching part, and we heard a little bit about that in the, I want to kind of digress a little bit from the diversity inclusion, if you wouldn't
Please.
Mind, right, on the teaching part. We heard that in the first presentation. Remember the blue chevron with the red chevrons that could be derailers for your life here? And similar to HP, kind of, yes, we give a very generous kind of maternity and paternity leave on the first chevron, but Amgen's activity already starts on the second chevron. We kind of really engage in kindergarten, on science fairs with judging. We want to essentially excite people for science and mathematics early in their life. And then the next stage, we have our SMILE program where we, it's from fourth grade onwards to 12th grade post kind of school, where we teach people science and mathematics in a very kind of hands-on work so they understand it and get it more ingrained. Then we have the College Crusaders that focuses on increasing the high school graduate rates. And then one of our hallmarks is the biotech, the Amgen biotech experience. We use our Amgen Foundation, our charitable foundation, kind of to really oversee all of this. But the Amgen biotech experience is one of our cornerstones since year one of our existence here. We have, in the history, trained over 700,000 students in the United States, trained 1,500 teachers in almost 1,000 schools. And what we bring into these classrooms, training the teacher, is molecular biology and microbiology experiments so that people get excited mm-hmm. for the science, right? And hopefully with a few, hopefully more women than boys, right, kind of girls and boys, it sticks. And they really want to pursue a career in science, right? And then it continues. Kind of we essentially help them from kindergarten onwards up to the point where they enter a company like ours or one of our kind of competitors kind of really, but they are excited about the science. They are excited about innovating medicines for the next 20 or 30 years. And that's how we have very systematically built that kind of domino and network of helping students. And we do this customized in every region a little bit different. And in Rhode Island, there are certain kind of programs we foster a little bit more on than on others. But it's customized to the location.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Quick follow-up for you, Scott. So, you know, Rhode Island has a number of communities of color, some of them not doing particularly well from an economic perspective. What is it that the state does to try to break some of the economic cycles there and try to get those folks into the mainstream of the economy?
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest part of it is if you don't have the kind of connection that Amgen is building, you can't see yourself, even if you had the talent to do it, you can't see yourself engaged in an industry. So, the Labor Department showing up at diverse locations and saying, "Hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help," is not the most effective way to do it. So, again, it's this partnership, right? So we partner with, you know, hundreds of different community organizations and, build those kinds of pathways so that people who they are more familiar with and work with on a regular basis are able to hear about a possibility and then say, "Oh, you mean there's a training opportunity for me, and you know I can go and work on a team that builds drugs at Amgen and the whole other side of Rhode Island, which is a 20-minute drive, but in Rhode Island that's far." And the answer is yes, and we'll give you the skill sets to do it. And not only that, you have a very welcoming place because you happen to be amazing at mathematics and love process, and we have a place to really plug you into the economy. So it's that partnership that makes things real for people.
That's great.
And I think this is how our relationship actually started. We told you before, these 150 people, most of them, they will join the company on three different kind of entry levels. And as we were looking in the local community, we looked at the university. There's a few people with a master's degree who we could kind of bring in from there. Then there was an educational center on the far other side of the spectrum of education. It was all built around the submarine kind of business in the state, generating welders, right? And we could have created a source process technicians from it, and then the college in the middle that had their own curriculum. And as we were doing this together with Scott, we recognized that the curricula all in itself kind of made sense, but they were not connected. So they were not seamlessly. You could start essentially tiptoeing into our industry with a few kind of night classes, seeing if this interests you, and then build on that really to ultimately get a university degree, but you don't have to. So we actually use some of the investments kind of that the state is making to really work with these academic institutions to augment the existing curricula so that at the end it's a cohesive story. Mm-hmm. All right, so that we can, and students, whenever they feel they have to leave or want to leave out of an educational path, they can leave, and they found a landing spot at a company such as Amgen. There is no gap at that moment. If they want to continue, they can continue on the academic career pathway as well. So this is what really brought both of us together, and we're all kind of excited. And as we talk about with new companies that are interested to join our little environment and ecosystem in Rhode Island, they also get excited about that kind of picture that we are framing up for them, right?
Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Thank you very much. Now, normally, we have about a minute left in the actual panel, so normally I would start to pivot to getting awesome questions from the audience, but I'm going to take moderator's prerogative here, and I'm going to ask one last question of Bill, because... because there's really an interesting issue in, or was an interesting issue that HP encountered setting up shop in Boise. And that has to do with white supremacists. So
always a great thing to have around.
Oh, always a great thing to have around, and always a great note on which to end the panel.
I've never heard anybody get a laugh. Good job.
I have security in that one.
Yeah. So tell us a little about, you know, the presence of white supremacists in Boise and some of the challenges that that posed for HP, particularly if you want to hire a diverse workforce, global workforce, and how that was managed.
Very good. So real quick, I'm going to ask the audience a question. One word only. If I say the state of Idaho, what's the first thing you think of? Thank you. We appreciate that. Potatoes, which, by the way, is not our number one agricultural crop. It's actually dairy, which is a big reason why Chobani came in. By the way, along with an incredibly powerful workforce driven by refugees. Boise has actually been the highest per capita refugee resettlement city in the United States of America for the last 20 years, and we're very proud of that. But kind of an aside there. The reason I say that, if I would have asked you this question 25 years ago, there's a good chance you would have said something like Aryan Nations or white supremacy. And the reason you would have said that, for folks that don't have the recollection, in the late 70s and early 80s, the Aryan Nations bought a large piece of property near Hayden Lake in northern Idaho with the stated intention of creating a separate white homeland within the United States. They literally wanted to separate from the United States in northern Idaho, a little bit of eastern Washington. And unfortunately, that's who Idaho became known for, right? We were the state with the Aryan Nation, with the white supremacists. Now, it was always a relatively small part of our population, relatively isolated, but nonetheless, that was our brand. I can't say that HP or any of the local business community kicked out the white supremacists. That distinction goes to a late Catholic priest by the name of Father Bill Wasmuth. And in fact, if you want to read his book, it's fabulous. It's called Hate Is My Neighbor. Horrible story, fabulous book. But Father Bill literally drove these folks out through legal means, through nonviolent means. I mean, you go down the route. But nonetheless, we still had this reputation as the state of white supremacy. It's, you know, potatoes is fantastic. And so in the mid-90s, there was a touring Anne Frank Memorial that came to Boise. And it drew tens of thousands of people. And it became very clear to the community leaders, including the business community, that there was pent-up demand for not just not having white supremacists, but being very much on the record around how we feel about human rights and the treatment of people. From that became the Center for Human Rights, eventually renamed later to the Father Bill Wasmuth Center for Human Rights. And so in Boise, Idaho, formerly known for the place with white supremacists and the Aryan Nations, we actually have the country's only Anne Frank Memorial. We're one of the few places in the world that has on permanent display the United Nations Declaration for Human Rights. And we have this organization that actively is out teaching in the schools so we can get to folks early, right? Because, you know, hate is taught. Nobody wakes up born hating, and people get to them along the way. And we want to make sure that we get to them early in life in the schools to make sure that they get a complete picture, as well as, frankly, a monitoring function. We don't want to have this happen again and have it be a surprise, and all of a sudden, you know, this large piece of property has been purchased and all these folks have moved in. And you know, the motto is Idaho, a state too great for hate. And so through community leadership, I think we've been effective not just in changing the brand, and I use that as an example to evidence the fact that 25 years ago you might not have said potatoes and now you did. That's actually the secondary and least important part. The most important part is we have redefined ourselves now as a very inclusive community. Now, we've got work to do in terms of actually making the numbers reflect that. But nonetheless, it's kind of a first step along the way and was a very, very powerful story in the state.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that. Thank you to all of you for your great perspectives. What we're going to do now is sort of shift to the audience. And I'm sure with all these, I mean, four fabulous panelists, that you have some questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take two or three at a time, and then to make sure we get, you know, a full range of questions, and then let the panelists decide which ones they want to answer. So if we can get the mics working, it would be great. So we have one, two, three over here.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Stefan Turnipseed. I'm with a company called Pitsco Education. We work in the K-12 space primarily. And as you know, there's some compelling challenges with the education space today, especially in the K-12 around a number of areas. One of the challenges that I wonder how you've addressed and how you do manage this is so often corporations engage in rather checkbook philanthropy as their primary vehicle. And unfortunately, that while that's good, unfortunately, money isn't really the problem if you really take a large statistical thing or statistical look at it. How do you engage in a direct manner with these children, with the school system, to materially change the environment, the climate, if you will, inside the schools where in Rhode Island and in Idaho? How do you actually, or do you?
Okay, so question about environment in schools, but I think also I'm going to broaden your question a little bit about environment outside of the schools, because there's a lot of research that shows, and Jim and Emil mentioned this too, that the environment surrounding the schools is important because most learning actually takes place outside of the schools, right? Right. So that's question number one. So question number two.
Hi, Gretchen Phillips. Thanks for your presentation. Just a quick question. We started with Marcella taking us through this fascinating data to how to think for companies and governments to think about how they might locate and expand. I'm just curious to hear your take as leaders in the private sector and the public sector on what from that framework really resonates and where you see the strength in the application of that. Would you actually use that to think about where you located? And are there key factors that drive your thinking that would not be captured in that framework, which are worthy of consideration?
Okay. Question on the framework and the implementation and application of that. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Joshua Muskin from Geneva Global. I want to thank you all for this uplifting and inspiring set of stories. But I'd like to challenge some of the optimism. Also bringing in the discussion this morning from the automation, and focus particularly on the goal that you set, Marcella, of accelerating job growth. And I don't share the optimism that with automation and the sort of job growth statistics that you're presenting, that there's meaningful work for everybody in the future. And just want to get some feedback on the difference between preparing youth today, children today, for meaningful employment, productive employment in the future, and rather preparing them for meaningful, I'll use the word, occupations. So thinking of a guaranteed salary or guaranteed wage that doesn't require you to justify your ability to meet a certain living standard because you're contributing to the economy, but because you're occupied, fulfilled in those sorts of ways. So wondering where that fits into this discussion at all. Thank you.
Okay, great. So we have a question about influencing opportunities to influence the learning environment very broadly, both inside and outside of schools. Another one on whether the framework that was presented, which really focuses on shared occupational similarities, is one that could be used or that you in part use when you make decisions about where to locate, et cetera. And then a third question about the nature of a growing economy. Does the growing economy necessarily mean increased employment, or does it mean that some people will be employed in the more traditional sense, but others will be occupied, meaning doing something that potentially isn't, where you're not potentially paid, and how do we prepare people, if that's a scenario, how do we prepare people for those kinds of opportunities? So those are our three initial questions.
Cool. I'm happy to take the last one first as people think about it, because it is, I think you're right. And I don't think I will say that I am necessarily an optimist. The reason we're doing this work is because I think the system will not solve it by itself. And what we've seen, again, there's friction in the system, and there have been very important changes when we've had friction in the past to solve it. Secondary education appeared when we had the agricultural revolution. That was big. We need dramatically different scaffolding for the changes that we're going to see. So I have in the report a talk about the promise of automation. I believe in what Needy talks about, is that it has the potential of really making jobs better, because jobs have become worse. And sometimes technology has worsened the jobs. It gives us platforms that in to be able to compartmentalize work and actually knowing that I have a 100% turnover rate if I'm a retail company, I want to make the difference between two employees, non-existent, so that if he doesn't come to work because babysitting, fell through, I can put this other worker and make them interchangeable, which means that the knowledge that that person brings is not specific, right? And pay them as low as possible. So guess what? Which means that that he's going to have more babysitting problems. And instead of saying, how can I change my operational model as a company so that I can create better jobs that actually allow me to pay people better, right? And that's an operational choice for companies to do. And I think there needs to be a lot more research, a lot more examples. And there's work from Zeynep Tong at MIT talking about, like, what are those changes to give workers more agency, allow them to make different jobs, so that I can afford it. But I also think that, as we've seen it, my background is in economic development. I've seen this in countries where we are seeing the growth of an informal sector in the U.S., right? All these jobs that took us a century to build, the infrastructure of benefits, is being dismantled. So it's not that jobs don't exist. It's that's the kind of gig economy is taking that role of the informal sector in many of these countries. So I do think that aside from pursuing very tailored, growth toward more complex industries, there's a whole set of other companies that need to lift the bottom so that those jobs are, allow people to have a good quality of life.
Excellent. Any thoughts on influencing the educational environment outside or inside schools?
So one of the things that we're doing in Rhode Island is investing fairly in a targeted way, but in a big way, on summer internship opportunities. So, again, I think we tend, at least in my experience, to do the things we're familiar with. My parents are teachers. I'll become a teacher. My parents do something. I'll do that. And I think that's mostly about horizontal possibilities. You see what you can actually do,
right,
and you tend to do it. So in Rhode Island, we are recruiting very talented kids who otherwise might not be able to have a really integrated internship as rising seniors, mm-hmm, and teach them soft skills in a boot camp kind of way, actually pay them all summer long so they're making some money and able to save, and with care curating internships in great companies like Amgen, CVS, General Dynamics, Electric Boat, smaller accounting firms, all kinds of firms where these students are really going to spend some time with somebody who's going to pay attention to them at the company and leave them with a feel for, bet you never knew what they did at an insurance company. And it's kind of interesting.
Right.
So maybe when you're done, maybe you go to college. Maybe you work at Amica Insurance. So that kind of program, I think, is one that shows a lot of promise. Yeah.
The educational question at the beginning was an interesting one, right? Kind of, if we all reflect a little bit of how we learned when we were kind of in school, we often probably had something written in front of us. We learned through books, right? These days, education has much further advanced. I'm no longer reading actually books or instruction manuals. I hop on YouTube to immediately sequester in 5 minutes three different opinions of how this piece needs to be changed. And I immediately have a knowledge level kind of infused in me much faster than I ever had in the past by just reading. So to answer your question, I think it's a multifaceted kind of answer to this. In some classes, you go in, kind of you teach with kind of a dialogue, with interaction, right? Kind of some people learn the fastest that way. But you should also think about not everybody essentially in the world is able to go to school every day, right? With the ubiquitousness of this device here, you can reach a lot more people than a school class every day. And there's an academy called the Khan Academy, where many large companies contribute to, ours as well, with educational material. It reaches kind of kids everywhere in the world. They only need a computer or a cell phone, and they can just learn in 5 minutes the fundamentals of mathematics or part of mathematics, right? So keep that in mind as well. It is not only about the class and the ratio between a teacher and the class. These days, there's many, many multiple avenues of teaching available to the world than maybe at the times when we learned, right, mm-hmm. Scott?
Yeah.
Excellent. So to your question about the use of the tools, I'm going to say, why don't we follow up with the panelists afterwards? I think each of them has talked about the factors that they use and thinking about how whether to expand or to set up shop. So I think you can just follow up with them afterwards. I'm going to take two more questions, and then we're going to head to lunch. So I have a gentleman here and young lady here, and those are going to be our last two.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Parag Mehta. I'm with the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. I've heard Marcella tell the Boise story before, and it's fascinating to hear your perspective on it. One piece I'm missing is, in the last 30 or 40 years, what happened to the children of the HP employees? You talked about the statewide statistics on education, but did those kids get a good quality education? Did those kids start learning, prepare to learn? Did they get the skills that you would be looking for? And what percentage of those kids decided to stay in Boise after they finished school? Did any of them come to work for HP?
Yeah, so multifaceted question. So first, with respect to the kids of HP employees, and I'm a HP father with kids, you know, living and growing up in Boise, as I said, our outcome statistics really are, you know, kind of developing economy. We're bottom of the 50 states, you know, 47, 48, and don't compare well favorably to other countries. But it's a tale of two cities. Right, so if you're in the city of Boise proper or one of the surrounding metros, we actually have very good education systems, very good outcomes. In fact, our kids are even fortunate to get some better college acceptance rates, because if you've ever read a college press release, it talks about SATs, ACTs, yearbook editors, number of states, number of countries. Well, guess what? There's always a kid from California. There's not always a kid from Idaho. So within the Boise metropolitan area, our education's actually pretty good and on par with other places. But that also is, you know, 600,000-700,000, I should even say about 500,000 of our economy, because 200,000 in the outlying areas are more like rural Idaho. That means we have 1 million kids that are getting an absolute subpar education, right? So if you've got a weighted average and you got the 500,000, you know, kids, offspring of 500,000 up here, you know, that's what's down here. And so we have a rural issue to address. So first part of your question, if you want to come to work for HP in Boise, Idaho, come. Your kids will have a great education. But it doesn't mean we can ignore the rest of the state. In terms of retention, I don't know the statistics on it. Anecdotally, I would say about half stay. We do get kids into Boise State, into Idaho that come back. I have a lot of those graduates working for me. I also recruit a lot of talent from all over the world. And in fact, I'm not from Boise, Idaho, right? So we bring folks in from everywhere. And yes, it's a company where we have multiple generations, like Amgen. I'm 21 years at HP. I'm still the new guy, right? And so we have multiple generations that work through. And in fact, I think I've got two or three kids of my peers working in my organization now.
Great, excellent. One more question. There was a young lady over here. We're going to take that.
Hi, my name is Hiwat Kebramariam. I work for USDA Department of Agriculture, Rural Development. My question revolves around the use of technology to potentially improve diversity and inclusion, especially in the context of having remote workforce. Have you seen a trend in your research where co-location is not only determined by having a close physical space, but also, you know, kind of determined by technology space or internet? And are there policies that you would recommend or already in place that is considering use of technology to connect for example, rural workforce or remote workforce with urban counterparts, and our industries thinking of this opportunity to recruit workforce in remote areas and rural areas?
Hard question to end with. This is the question. And it's something that, you know, Representative Roe kind of talked about, of why this is a challenge, which is interesting about growth, is that, you know, growth is not inclusive by nature. It's actually exclusive by nature. You know, this capability approach that we talked about, it aggregates in places. There's a reason why cities become the engines of growth. And that's why you have to be very purposeful, right? Even technology, with the advent of technology and then Skype and blah, blah, the value of proximity has actually increased rather than decreased. So the way that we think about inclusive growth is, you know, how do you allow people to participate in the networks that make them more productive in our economy? And these networks can be physical, the roads, the infrastructure, and it sounds redundant, but those are things that still we don't have in America. You know, thinking that broadband is still not a given in rural America, that's like the most basic way in which many of these people are going to be able to participate while staying in the country. It's not part of the schooling system. It's got to be part of the whole system, but it's a given. And I just learned today it was only $40 billion. So it really, that should be a no-brainer. But also we're trying to understand what are the business model. I mean, cities also are expensive, and there are certain industries and certain models beyond agriculture that can be disaggregated to function successfully in rural areas, and trying to understand which are those industries that can work in rural areas is important. But I think creating these networks to bring people in using technology, of which, you know, broadband is the 101, I think it's part of the solution, and the kind of work that Needy talked about of making sure that the capacity to contribute to this industry is dispersed. And that has to be very purposeful. Equally for companies who decide to recruit, it doesn't happen naturally. And this is what I'm hoping, that in a tight labor market, that and all the things that we're starting to see of this, the social consequences of this unequal growth, it's going to create a more dramatic impetus for companies to go beyond the cities.
Well, I have a couple of announcements that you'll want to hear, but before doing that, I want to thank Marcella, Scott, Thomas, and Bill. As you know, events at Brookings are really a team effort. It really takes a lot of professionals to pull this together. So I also want to thank our event staff, our facility staff, and our fabulous security staff. We are going to be moving into lunch. So it's going to be set up in the hallway, and there's also an overflow room over there. There's additional seating available. If you have any questions, please ask our staff. We all have name tags on. I want to stress that it's going to be really important for you to be back here by 1:55 so we can get the next panel started. And with that, I want to thank you all for coming, and I also want to thank our online audience as well. Thank you very much.